This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
April. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor for Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist. This show is airing on the weekend of April the 3rd, 2010.
Podcasting everywhere.
And I heard that a station is picking us up in Australia, but I haven't confirmed that yet. So
you said that last week, Dan.
I know. Well, I'll have to ask them if we really are. If you are, good day, mates. Free Thought Radio, this show is the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, a national organization composed of atheists and agnostics working to educate the public about what we think as atheists and agnostics
and freethinkers.
And freethinkers and whatever else we call ourselves. We just don't believe. And also, we work to keep state and church separate. My son Danny, he calls himself an agnostic. He told me a joke this week. A new family came to the United States of America. They didn't know much about American culture. And the little boy asked the dad, "Daddy, what is this Santa Claus thing?" And Daddy said, "Well, Santa is this big red guy in a red suit, and he brings presents every Christmas." "And what is the Easter Bunny?" "Oh, the Easter Bunny is this rabbit that lays eggs and brings candy, and you go look for candy all the time, in the first of springtime." "And what is God?" And Dad says, "Oh, God, well, you know, when you want something really, really bad and you pray for it because you really want it really bad?" "Yeah." "Well, God is the person who ignores you."
All right. Well, thank you, Danny, for that joke. And we're going to talk later in the show with John W. Loftus, who's a former fundamentalist minister like Dan, now an atheist, and about his new anthology. Dan wrote the foreword. And what's that book called?
It's called The Christian Delusion, Why Faith Fails.
But in this so-called Holy Week, we do now want to talk about some of the unholy things going on right now with religion.
Including the ever always renewed pedophilia scandal in the Roman Catholic Church.
New York Times columnist, Maureen Dowd, has been very funny this past week, asking whether there should be an inquisition for the Pope. And that's kind of a play on words because the current pope, known as Benedict, used to be head of the church's Latter-day Inquisition. That's now known as the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faithful. He was Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, and Ratzinger headed it from 81 to 2005, and he was actually in charge, the first in command, in deciding whether to try and defrock accused priests in thousands of cases, by the way. And hey, if Maureen asked me personally whether we should put the Inquisition onto the pope's case, I'd vote yes.
Remember my song, the Stay Away Pope Polka? "We will never get away from the bloody dark ages till we've excommunicated the Pope." Not a bad idea. Maureen Dowd also quipped that the church gave up its credibility for Lent. She suggested that the church tape 30-second spots to defend Benedict and end them with the Pope saying, "I'm infallible and I approve this message."
Well, we'll talk some more about that unholy cover-up in the next segment, but I do want to talk also about the holy violence during this so-called Holy Week, and there's been an awful lot of it. The New York Times reported on Sunday, it was a huge front-page story, on the Lord's Resistance Army, one of the most infamous armed groups in Africa, and reported that it has recently killed hundreds of villagers in the Congo, raped and kidnapped hundreds more.
The Lord's Resistance Army, it's a guerrilla campaign by a Christian sectarian group. It started in 1987 in Uganda to establish a theocratic state based on the Ten Commandments. It's one of the most brutal and feared armed movements. It's known for massacres, rape, torture, mutilation, pressing children to become soldiers, and you name it.
And can you imagine if armed forces known as the Atheist Resistance Movement had caused this kind of misery and bloodshed. This kind of violence, of course, is generally condemned, but it's never apologetically admitted by the Christian world. It's never considered to reflect on Christianity, but in fact, this kind of horror is being done in the name of religion and Christianity.
So too, in the name of Christianity, is a militia in the Midwest, which the FBI raided last week in Michigan. They're also in Indiana and Ohio. It's identified as a Christian militia group. The members may be affiliated with Hutari. They're hung up on the apocalypse, the idea of an antichrist. The website says, Jesus wanted us to be ready to defend ourselves using the sword and stay alive using equipment.
So that's pretty scary stuff. And of course, I have to comment on the 38 or more people killed in Moscow subways by female suicide bombers last week. And yes, I agree the Chechens are living under military occupation. That's very wrong. But however, just their grievances, they are nevertheless Muslims who are able to recruit suicide bombers because of religious ideology. And Muslim suicide bombers are killing innocent people around the world. And that's wrong.
So this is not just Holy Week, it's Holy War Week. Well, let's turn to a more pleasant topic. The topic of the resurrection. Well, not the resurrection of Jesus, but the resurrection of spring.
Yes, and thanks to our unseasonable weather, my garden is already blooming daffodils. That's very early for us here in Wisconsin. Scilla, crocuses, glory of the snow, snowdrops, and tulips are going to be next.
So speaking of the resurrection, on Easter Sunday, you may hear this hymn being played in many churches.
Up from the grave he arose with a mighty triumph for his foes. He arose the victor from the dark domain, and he lives forever with his saints to reign.
Oh, okay, enough of that, Dan.
Wait, listen to this.
He arose.
I used to sing this song in church all the time. We were all excited about Jesus rose from the dead. But actually, the resurrection of Jesus is something that's just stolen. Easter was stolen, just like they stole the trimmings of Christmas. The symbolism of the resurrection, spring, rebirth, and fertility. And, you know, Easter was a goddess of spring, Astarte, Ostra, and the Egyptians had their yearly cycle of the death and resurrection, the daily cycle of the death and resurrection of their Osiris, symbolizing the coming spring and the fertility of the soil and all that. So Christianity was piggybacking on that. And notice when Easter Sunday is.
When is it, Dan?
Well, that's right, in the beginning of spring. Isn't that a coincidence?
But it's also like a floating holiday having to do with the first...
Yeah, with the vernal equinox.
The first full first Sunday after the first full moon after the vernal equinox.
Yeah. So it's
another natural holiday, basically.
And if Jesus really did rise on a certain date, then we would celebrate that date in history. But of course, there's no real date when it happened.
And I think we're going to skip talking about yesterday's Good Friday. We're very fortunate that we did get Good Friday law overturned in Wisconsin, but we have a few things to mop up about that. But we'll skip that very grim day. And let's talk about your Easter challenge, Dan, that you have had floating around for about 20 years. What is that, briefly?
The Easter challenge is called Leave No Stone Unturned, and it appears in my 1992 book, Losing Faith in Faith, but probably earlier than that. The challenge was not to prove the resurrection, but just to state it. Take all of the accounts in the New Testament. There's at least five accounts and a couple other snippets from five different authors in the New Testament who tell the so-called story of the resurrection of Jesus, but they don't agree with each other in so many details. The number of people, the message that was said, how many angels were there, what was their purpose, what time of day was it, was the stone moved when they arrived, and so on. My book gives about 17 different contradictions.
And of course, when you're talking about this, a lot of this is very ridiculous, isn't it?
Well, yeah. Yeah, earthquakes. You know, supposedly there were these two huge earthquakes in Matthew. One of them opened the graves and these zombies came walking around the city.
So the night of the living dead.
And then the next one rolled the stone. So that must have been like Haiti. That must have been like this huge, massive thing. And yet the next morning, everybody's just casually going about their business. They should be attending to the sick and the wounded and emergency operations and digging dead bodies.
There should have been some secular historians noting this.
Yeah, that too, right? So anyway, it's ridiculous. But the point of my challenge was for somebody to take all these different accounts, put them together without omitting a single detail into one seamless narrative from beginning to end chronologically and tell the story. No one's been able to do that. A few people have tried, but their attempts have done so much damage to the actual words that it's laughable. But even Christian scholars agree that the resurrection of Jesus, that story actually cannot even be coherently told in a single chronological narrative. So I've had this challenge for almost two decades now to just explain what happened on Easter morning.
I'm Annie Laura Gaylor with Dan Barker. Free Thought Radio will be right back after a short break to talk about the Christian delusion with a former fundamentalist minister, John Loftus, and that's the name of his new book.
And we'll also talk about how the Freedom From Religion Foundation was very early in sounding the alarm over clergy abuse of children and the cover-up in the Roman Catholic Church. And we'll talk about the current scandals in the church during this so-called Holy Week.
And just a little reminder first that the only, or I guess a confession, that the only Easter ritual our family gets involved in now that kids are all grown, there's no jelly bean hunts, involves watching Easter Parade on TV because...
The movie.
Because my father-in-law...
Dan's dad,
is in it. And, well, he has cameo anyway. And I have to admit, we don't always watch the entire movie. It's pretty darn long. But we at least try to watch the beginning, where you will catch the young Norman Barker's trombone solo with a very flirtatious Judy Garland.
1948, Irving Berlin's movie, Easter Parade. Let's go out just listening to a little bit of my dad playing while Judy Garland is singing.
I want to go back to that old farm, far away from harm, with a milk pail on my arm. I miss the rooster that used to wake me up at 4 a.m. I think your great big city's very pretty, nevertheless.
Hi, my name is Emily Lozier from Sherwood, Wisconsin, and I'm on Free Thought Radio.
The things that you're liable to read in the Bible... It ain't necessarily so. This is Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Annie Laura Gaylor with Dan Barker.
And coming up later, we're going to talk with John W. Loftus, whom we've had on our show before. He's the former fundamentalist minister who wrote the book Why I Became an Atheist. He has a new book out. It's an anthology called The Christian Delusion, Why Faith Fails.
And we'll be speaking with John on the second half of today's show.
Now we want to talk about the Roman Catholic institutionalized crimes by priests against children and the cover-ups.
And of course, the Pope's Palm Sunday sermon last week really inflamed the issue, and you'll recall that particular remark he made. He said, "From God comes the courage not to be intimidated by petty gossip." He was referring to international
outcries and news of
cover-up and terrible crimes in Ireland, Germany, Wisconsin. And so I thought it was very poignant when Associated Press ran a photograph of one of the many victims of the Wisconsin predator that's been part of the scandal, Lawrence C. Murphy, Father Murphy, who ran a school for the deaf, a Catholic school for the deaf. And the name of this man is Arthur Pudzinski, and he was one of 200 victims. He's now nearly elderly, and he was standing there holding a sign directed in response to the Pope's comment in Milwaukee, and it said, "I'm not petty gossip."
Well, powerful. And a lot of people probably don't realize, a lot of listeners to this show, Annie Laurie, that the Freedom From Religion Foundation has been on top of this issue earlier than almost anyone else, back in the late 1980s, and that, in fact, you wrote the first nonfiction book about the issue, calling the alarm on it in 1988. The book was called Betrayal of Trust, Clergy Abuse of Children, published by the foundation. What prompted you way back then to write that book?
I became editor of the newspaper that the Freedom From Religion Foundation publishes, called Free Thought Today that started coming out in 84. I joined on as editor in 85, and we were receiving clippings from, it seemed like, most of our members. There were maybe 1,000 or 2,000 at the time, and I had very heavy mail, as I have heavy mail and email today, but it was still heavy then. And I would get all these bizarre clippings. It would say priest rapes child convicted, or ex-priest, they would usually say, or ex-minister. And then you'd read the story and find that it was actually somebody who was not an ex-minister. They had simply been removed briefly while the investigation went forward. And I just thought, well, this is lurid. This is scandalous. And I would throw them away. And then I started realizing I seemed to be getting more clippings about sex crimes by clergymen than any other issue.
And people sending them in thought they were like an anomaly.
Yeah, and a lot of them were from little newspapers. They weren't necessarily wire stories. They were just all around the country. They weren't just Catholic, they were Protestants. So I decided to do an experiment, and I put the clippings in a drawer and let them accumulate for a month. And I had a bulging drawer at the end of the month. I went through them, and I realized there was a pattern. There was a pattern in many of these, especially the Catholic, but not just the Catholic, of collusion and cover-up and blaming the victim and distancing the church from the predator, like calling the person an ex-minister when they really had not been defrocked, and that it was alarming.
And moving the priest around.
Moving the priest around. And so we started reporting it. I used to call it the fruits of religion. By you fruits, you shall know them, is in the New Testament. And I was also reporting on other kinds of violence, too. And that was when the pattern became very, very clear. And I grew concerned that not only were the police not policing the churches, but the churches weren't policing themselves, and they were getting away with it. And there was a huge number of victims, and it was a state church as well as a churchly scandal.
Is it any different now, 20 years later?
Well, hardly. I mean, you know, every 10 years, the media and the world rediscovers that there is a cover-up going on in the Catholic Church. And I did want to talk, since we are here in Wisconsin, about the one of the cases that reflects on the current Pope, because he was the main investigator of these cases for 20-some years, and that is this nightmare involving the predator, Lawrence Murphy, whom we talked about, who was preying on deaf children and used to sometimes read the Bible, and he did sign language as well, before reaching for the kids, and he was a complete predator, molesting them in closets, calling it a sacrament. And for almost 5 decades, victims tried to do something about it. They were repulsed. And they were repulsed by Milwaukee's DA, a Catholic, E. Michael McCann. And finally, in 1996, the third archbishop in the cover-up wrote Ratzinger, the current pope, before he was pope, that they needed some kind of healing action. Nothing ever happened, and the guy died with a nice funeral in 1998. And we did a blog about this article and said not only should the Pope resign, but good Catholics should resign from the church. That until there is that kind of outcry, the withdrawal of support, people ashamed to be calling themselves associated with this institution, I don't think things are going to change.
Instead, some are ashamed to be associated with our
show. Right,
we got
turned down by a member of SNAP, Wisconsin spokesperson, who did not want to be interviewed by atheists. You know, more still a Catholic and still more hung up on that, this church that hurt her, than just doing an interview with us. So I was rather shocked. And I think that it is not enough to pray about the issue. You have to vote with your feet here. That this has gotten too much attention for people to turn a blind eye. And it really is institutionalized. And it's also going to involve the state finally going after a bishop or archbishop for cover-up. And that has yet to happen. There's never been a prosecution. So, you know, I wrote this book in 88, and have things changed? You know, of course, only begrudgingly, with the church forced to do little small reforms.
So
but
where
nothing
is
really.
Where is the district attorney who has the courage to step up and prosecute a bishop or an archbishop for these cover-ups? It hasn't happened yet. And doesn't that say something about the power of the church to intimidate the authorities?
Yes, it's the largest denomination in the country. So you can read more about that, like I said, at FFRF's new blog. You go to the news link at FFRF to find it. You can also read our thoughts about that White House Seder last week.
You can find all that at ffrf.org. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor, and you're listening to Free Thought Radio. We're going to be right back after this break to talk with John W. Loftus, a former fundamentalist preacher who saw the light. His first book is Why I Became an Atheist. His newest book, hot off the press, is called The Christian Delusion, Why Faith Fails. And I think this is a powerhouse, scholarly, but accessible book. Don't miss the rest of our show.
Hi, this is Jack Holmes. I'm from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I'm a member of FFRF, and I'm on Free Thought Radio.
Beware of dogma. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Lergiller with Dan Barker.
And we have on the phone with us today from Indiana, John Loftus. We had John on the show, about a year and a half ago, was it? He told us his story about being a preacher who became an atheist, which in many ways paralleled my own story, so it's fun to know John and talk to him. And we talked about his previous book, which is called Why I Became an Atheist, A Former Preacher Rejects Christianity. John W. Loftus is also the founder of a blog. It's called Debunking Christianity, which you can find at debunkingchristianity.blogspot.com. John has a brand new book out. He's an editor of a new anthology. It's called The Christian Delusion, Why Faith Fails. It just came out this week, and it's a powerhouse book. The God Delusion by Dawkins is a powerful outsider look, and it was sort of a broad look at religion. But here is a book by people who are experts, who are scholars, who know Christianity from the inside, a book of incredible depth. And welcome to Free Thought Radio, John.
Well, it's good to be here.
Great to have you back again. So why the new book?
Well, there's this, I call the Christian faith by the word ship. It's a good Christian ship. And it won't go down easily. It needs broadside after broadside after broadside to go down. And I thought to myself that there's more to say. I had originally written my book, and I'm not an expert in every area that I wrote about. I did research, and I did the best I could on some topics, but whenever you write a book about God and the universe, you're not going to be an expert on everything. So I thought, well, since the good ship Christian needs to go down, and since I don't have all the expertise needed, I thought I would enlist the help of a lot of experts to take up where I left off and to further argue for the things that I did in my previous book.
But you were a preacher and you were an apologist and you had worked as a defender of the faith from the Bible. So you weren't just some Sunday school student. You really do know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I do. I just wanted, who better to write on Yahweh in the Old Testament than Hector Avalos?
Yeah, exactly.
And who better to write on how we got morality than a cultural anthropologist, David Eller, or who better to write on whether or not Christianity gave rise to science, but Richard Carrier, that sort of thing. I touched on those topics in my book, but these guys, they're experts, and all of them.
Robert Price on the historicity of Jesus.
Of course.
Well, hey, I got to work in that there's a woman. Is there at least one woman, right?
Yeah, psychologist.
Uh-huh. Valerie Tirico?
She's wonderful. She's written a book, that's how I got to know these authors. I read their books, and I contacted them, and some of us have met, and I thought to myself, you know what, we need to collaborate on something. So, so we did, and I like the result.
Well, I read all but two of the chapters. I just got my copy about 3 or 4 days ago, and it is deep, and it is powerful, and you have a section on there, not only why faith fails, which is the subtitle, but why the Bible is not God's word. From a scholarly point of view, why the Christian God is not perfectly good. Why right. Jesus is not the risen Son of God. A whole chapter on the problems with the resurrection by Carrier. And then, of course, my favorite was the last section, why society does not depend on Christian faith.
Well, Dan, you have to confess that you wrote the foreword too, right?
Oh, I don't do confessions
a little
anymore.
Bit of disinterested whatever.
And I thank you for that. That was really nice of you to do so.
So you, in your previous book, you mentioned what is very fast becoming a indispensable part of the Freethought arsenal, your outsider test. And then in this new book, you have a new chapter, The Outsider Test for Faith Revisited. So tell us a little bit about the outsider test and why you needed to write more about that.
Well, I got some feedback from it, and I wanted to articulate it better. I wanted to defend it better from some of the objections that I had heard from, you know, my previous book.
And what is it? What is the outsider test?
Yes. Well, basically it boils down to testing your own inherited faith with the same level of skepticism that you do when you evaluate the faiths that you reject as outsiders. I back it up with a lot of psychological and anthropological and sociological studies that show that, you know, we basically are raised as believers, all of us. We're taught to believe what our parents told us anyway, and that's what I mean when I say that. If they told us Santa Claus existed, then he existed until they said otherwise. If they had told us that Zeus existed, we would have believed it as children until, you know, they said otherwise. And if in the case of, like, the Christian faith, they never say, well, no, that's not real or God doesn't exist, then we continue to perpetrate that. And Muslim cultures do the same as do Hindu cultures and Orthodox Jewish cultures and Catholic and Protestant and, you know, name it. So given that the fact that, you know, well, basically we're indoctrinated or even brainwashed to believe certain things from our early upbringing in our particular case, the Christian culture, well, how are we to know whether or not we might be one of the brainwashed people? You know, how can we actually test that? And I have proposed testing it with the outsider test, with the same level of skepticism you used when you evaluate the faith that you reject. And my conclusion is that once you do that, you know, any revealed religion will not, you know, withstand the scrutiny of that test.
Could you give us an example of how you do that?
Well, okay, one thing is to just basically think about how you first came to believe. You know, I ask Christians to do that. You know, how did you first come to believe? Did you evaluate it before you came to believe? I mean, how did you scrutinize it? I tell people that if Christians were to do this, if they were to hand out an apologetics book or a Bible to some prospective believer, convert, and a copy of, say, well, your book, Dan, or mine, or some other good critique of Christianity, hand them both to a prospect and say, now, here, evaluate for yourself, you know, whether or not you want to adopt this faith, then I might be impressed. But instead, what evangelists do and what parents do is they just simply, you know, indoctrinate us. They just tell us what, you know, what's true, and we seem to adopt, you know, hook, line, and sinker. And so skepticism is not an inherited trait. We have to learn to be skeptics, and when we apply that skepticism across the board to, you know, all the religious faiths, especially our own, in the same manner, then we'll find out why faith fails.
That's what you and I both did in our own stories, having been preachers, and then taking that lens that we were using to look around the rest of the world, turning it around 180 degrees and pointing it at ourselves and saying, you know, we believe all these other people have this tendency to be so wrong. What makes me exempt? What's, you know, why am I any special? Why would an outsider be impressed with my views? And I think Valerie Tirico, as Annie Laurie was pointing out in her article in here, kind of addresses that whole idea. Her article is called Christian Belief Through the Lens of Cognitive science? What is it about our brains that make people so gullible and so resistant to skepticism?
Except you have to speak for yourselves, because some of us were never religious.
Well, some of you were lucky.
I know, but I don't always buy that there's something in our brain that wires us for religion. I think it's indoctrination from an early age. Well, what do you think, John?
Well, if you two are having a dispute, I really don't want to get in between you. But I do tend to think that it's indoctrination. I mean, that's nothing I'm an expert on.
But Valerie points out, why in the first place are people so malleable or eager? I mean, when the Mormons went over to England and started talking about the gold tablets and the angel and all this weird stuff, and the people said, okay, and they came back to Utah with them. I mean, what is it about human nature?
Not that many.
Well, but still.
A minority.
But still, proselytizing and missionizing actually works.
But those people were not atheists. They were already indoctrinated in a society that said religion is true, don't examine its claims, it's a taboo to criticize religion, just believe everything they're told about religion, right? So they were indoctrinated.
Yeah, but there still has to be some cognitive basis. You want to listen to our argument here, John. A cognitive basis for faith, and whatever side of that bell curve you fall on. Valerie does a great job of showing us why there is that susceptibility in all of us.
Well, let's talk about, which I have not had a chance to read this book yet, John, but because it just came, but Hector Avalos has a chapter in which what does he write about? He says Yahweh is a moral monster.
Yeah, it's a response to Paul Copan. He's the president of the Evangelical Philosophical Society, and he's one philosopher who is attempting to deal with the biblical material in the Old Testament in answering Dawkins' charge that the God of the Old Testament is the most despicable character in all fiction. And so Hector is basically responding to Paul Copan's defense of the biblical God, and I think Hector just rips him apart myself. just over and over, there's genocide, there's child sacrifice, there's infanticide, and all of Dr. Copan's arguments are efforts in special pleading, basically. And Hector says at the end, he says, basically, I'm not quoting him, he says, it's unbelievable that anybody in this modern age would be defending genocide. But that's what Paul Copan ends up doing.
And a lot of these apologetics of believers are doing just that. They are looking the other way, they're making excuses, they're trying to... Well, Hector talks about all of these different, and these are scholarly. These aren't just street preachers. Copan is an educated, intellectual. So this book is responding just not to the people in the pews, but to actual intellectual criticisms of us freethinkers.
We're talking with John W. Loftus about the new book he's edited called The Christian Delusion, Why Faith Fails, and we'll be right back to continue that conversation in a minute.
Hi. This is Dave Carlson in Japan, and I really enjoy Free Thought Radio.
Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laura Gaylor with Dan Barker for Free Thought Radio. We're speaking with John W. Loftus by phone from Indiana about the new book he has edited. It just came out, I think, this week, The Christian Delusion, Why Faith Fails.
The philosopher Michael Martin says, this is arguably the best critique of the Christian faith the world has ever known. The scientist Victor Stenger says, major scholars show why Christianity is bankrupt. And the journalist William Lobdell, who's been on our show, says this is an incredibly powerful book, a must read. I wish a book like this was around when I first had my doubts about Christianity. Would have saved me many years in getting to the truth. So blurbs like that are very heartwarming to hear, aren't they, John?
Well, they're humbling, yes.
Yeah.
I'm excited to be a part of this. It's a team effort.
There's a lot in here, and you have four chapters. We want to talk about Robert Price's chapter as well. And in fact, when I debate Christian scholars, I debated one in Australia a couple weeks ago. He was impressed that I knew Robert Price, an atheist Bible scholar. But you were telling us that you couldn't squeeze everything into this book that you wanted to. Was there something that you had to leave out?
Well, what I meant is, I'd asked you what is not in this book, and I'll tell you what's not in this book, and it's by design. And there's nothing in it on the arguments for the existence of God. Natural theology is on the rise among evangelicals, and they want to tout the arguments for the existence of God, and a lot of those are just God of the gaps type of arguments, and they think that because they're smart on these topics that somehow that defends their faith. But I have a backhanded way of getting at that sort of argumentation, and that is looking at the Bible, looking at theology, looking at the God of the Bible, and asking ourselves, now, is this a God we can believe in? Because once those things undermine natural theology, then it's not long afterward where the former Christian will look at those former arguments that they used to herald and say, well, you know what? They're bunk. That's what I wanted you to ask. What's not in this is something about natural theology, because I consider natural theology to have been dead long ago with Karl Barth, and the revival of it is nothing but fundamentalism on stilts.
Well, you're attacking Christianity specifically, its teachings, and you probably know what Bertrand Russell said. When he was a young man, he was briefly convinced by the ontological argument
right.
that there was a God, but the next day he woke up and he said, oh, silly me, all these arguments are just bad grammar.
And again, for listeners, the ontological argument is what, Dan? Arguments for the existence of God is what that
means. It's one of those weird arguments based on, it's a metaphysical thing, you know. A perfect being can exist in conception or in actuality, and if he didn't exist in actuality, we could conceive him to be more greater. It's a silly argument.
It's never convinced anybody. Bertrand Russell might have been the only one who might have been convinced one day from it.
Yeah, for a couple hours.
So they tout those arguments as if they mean something, or as if they're convincing, and that they point to the God of the Bible. Well, if you look at what the God of the Bible is like, you don't find anything praiseworthy much in it, you know, and a lot of barbarism.
So what about Jesus? I know Robert Price is a towering expert on the historicity of Jesus. His chapter is called Jesus, Myth, and Legend. What does
right.
he say in there?
Well, you know, actually, by the way, I think that you might want to interview each of the authors of the book sometime if you can find the time, because they know their subject much better than I do.
Well, we had Robert on
recently,
a few months ago.
But we can be glad to have him on again.
But he's responding to Paul Eddy and Greg Boyd, who wrote the book, The Jesus Legend, where they basically argue against him. And Bob, he's a great guy. He just simply methodologically takes their method apart. They claimed not to like form criticism, but he shows, well, you know what, by the end of the day, that's what you're doing, you know. They say that with critical scholars that everything should be open game, and Bob just says, well, you know, if that's the case, then then historians would be open to every weeping statue of Mary and every claim that someone turned into a werewolf, et cetera. It's really good. I think, like I said, you should probably interview him on that. It's just, the principle of history, that we need to look at history from a methodological, natural standpoint, is something that he hammers on with them. I mean, that's just what we have to do when we're looking at the past. And, you know, it applies to Jesus' resurrection. You know, it applies to how we can know what Jesus said and whether even he exists. And,
yeah.
Well, so as a former fundamentalist minister, if you were to return to your pulpit on Sunday, Easter Sunday, with a short message of why you disbelieve or what you would want to convey to parishioners, your former parishioners, what would you say?
Well, I would say there's no evidence for the faith. I would say the reason why you believe in the first place is because you've been indoctrinated to believe, and psychology shows this, cultural anthropology shows that you've merely adopted the cultural assumptions of a Christian culture, and you were never reasoned into your faith, and that's why it's so hard to reason you out of it.
That's what David Eller says in his contribution.
Exactly. And Richard Carrier, he takes my outsider test for faith, and he applies it to the stories of the resurrection. You know, we really don't know who wrote those Gospels. We really can't believe what some ancient people have said about somebody who may not even have existed, you know, and if he did, I argue that, you know, at best he's an apocalyptic doomsday prophet. They've come a dime a dozen down through the generations, and to this date they've always been wrong. You know, there's just no way that we can assess that sort of stuff, especially since these authors had an agenda, and we can't cross-examine the witnesses, nor can we send Mike Wallace out on 60 Minutes to do a segment on you know, Jesus' resurrection. And he compares it to Herodotus, who's known as the father of history because he's also known to have checked his sources. And Herodotus says that some cooked fish were resurrected in front of a whole town.
And if we can't believe that, why do we believe the resurrection?
Exactly.
We're out of time here.
Well, thank you, John. Yep, for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Does your book have a website?
It does. It's hard to remember the exact
well, if
site,
they Google,
but just go to Debunking Christianity and you'll be able to find
it. You have a blog called debunkingchristianity.blogspot.com.
And so you can find out more about the God, the Christian delusion, why faith fails.
Two other contributors were Ed Bobinski and Paul Tobin that we haven't mentioned. So, So thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
And we also want to thank our engineer and producer, Brian Tirani. Free Thought Radio is recorded in Madison, Wisconsin. Our announcer is Buzz Kemper. Go to ffrf.org/radio for archives and podcasts of this show.
Ask for more information at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. You can get a free sample of the April issue of Free Thought today by phoning 1-800-335-4021 or go to ffrf.org. Thank you for listening. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday.